Welcome to Speak Like a CEO. My guest today is Alexander Osterwalder, the founder and CEO of Strategizer. Alex is an entrepreneur, leading author, and in-demand speaker and one of the world's most influential strategy and innovation experts. His books include the international bestsellers Business Model Generation, Value Proposition Design, and The Invincible Company. Together with Yves Pagnot, he invented the Business Model Canvas and the Value Proposition Canvas. And these are practical tools that are trusted by millions of business practitioners from leading companies as well as startups. He explains what makes a company invincible, what companies get right and wrong about innovation, how you can create a value proposition for your business that your customers love, and how storytelling helps businesses suspend disbelief and the unfamiliar. Enjoy this episode with one of the world's foremost strategy and innovation thinkers. Alex, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure to be here.
So one of your books is called The Invincible Company. What makes a company invincible?
It's a very arrogant title, right? What makes you invincible is when you do not believe you're invincible. Actually, when you believe that disruption can happen anytime and that companies that don't reinvent themselves, they die. If you believe that, then you will focus on reinventing yourself all the time. You will innovate, you will change, and you will keep it a culture of day one, as Jeff Bezos used to like to say.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I was thinking about this for some time now. And what triggered it was what happened with Google and AI. They're not the first, but they certainly have the biggest treasure trove of data. And as you know, in Silicon Valley and also here in Europe, we often talk about Kodak and Blockbuster. And these stories are well known of company really missed big, big, big developments. So I wonder whether the CEOs of today are more aware of these stories or whether they're just aware, but they don't act on them. What's your impression?
Yeah, I think people are very aware. So 40% of CEOs actually believe that their business model is not going to be economically viable within a decade. So they're very aware. 80% of companies put innovation on the top three. Now, where the problem comes in is that only 20% of companies are actually able to scale innovation. So there's a huge gap between ambition and the reality of how capable companies are to innovate. So very few companies are set up to constantly reinvent themselves. So that's the challenge. It's slowly changing, but the awareness is definitely here.
Mm-hmm. Let's double click on that. So what do companies get right and wrong when it comes to scaling innovation?
Well, I think the processes are not too bad, but they're somewhere in a basement without power and without kind of integration into the core organization. So I say you need to look at three things, and then you know if a company can innovate. Number one, how much time does the CEO spend on innovation? If the CEO doesn't spend 40% of their time on innovation, company will not innovate. Number two, you look at the power that the innovation people or department have. If innovation has no power, you cannot innovate. So they have to be, it has to be 100% job reporting to the CEO. And the third one is, are companies able to kill projects that do not have evidence that, it could work out? So rule of thumb is you need to kill 9 out of 10 projects to get one winner, and you can't pick the winner, the winners emerge. So if you can put a check mark on all three, you will innovate. If you can get 2 out of 3, maybe. If you get 0 out of 3 and you're going to have an innovation job, change your job, search for a different company, because it will not happen. I don't have the scientific research, but rule of thumb definitely applies. I've never seen it happen when these three things don't apply.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And my conversation with CEOs, the question is often, okay, how can we make that happen? The corporate venture studios, which were on vogue for some time, didn't work in my observation. Maybe you have different data, but it seems to me that companies are looking for a model that works. What's your view on this?
So, we say accelerators work or don't work. I think we're putting everything a bit in the same bucket. What you need to do is look at them under a loop. Some venture studios work and some don't. And you'll find a pattern of what works and what doesn't. So number one is that, letting a lot of projects start, accepting that 1 out of 10 will succeed, that's number one. So you can have an accelerator venture studio, a project comes in and they have to succeed. Guess what? They're going to play it safe. They're not going to innovate, or they're going to hide their failure. If you come into a project like this and then After 3 months, you have to show evidence. You have none that the customers don't have the problem and the project gets killed and it's okay. You don't risk your career. That's when it works. So I think we're kind of oversimplifying saying this works, that doesn't work. I think we now understand what needs to be in place for these things to work. And there are tons of vehicles, but there's a couple of principles. When those are in place, then a company innovates. And that, you know, I start with one. If you need to pick one, it's CEO time. If the CEO doesn't spend time on innovation, guess what? Then everybody sees it's not important. So it's the symbolic signal. You start with that, all of the other things start to fall in place if the CEO understands what the role of a CEO is in innovation.
Yeah. It's fascinating that you focus on the principles and not the vehicle that makes it happen. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. Before we dive deeper, I'd love to hear a little bit more about yourself. And you're probably best known to the listeners for The Business Model Canva, as a book that's been around for years. And is, you know, there have been several editions and it's very well known in the startup and innovation communities. How did this come about? How did you become such an expert in this field?
It's very simple. I was always interested in business models and technology. And I had the opportunity to do a PhD with Yves Pigneur, who's now my long-term friend and co-author. So we started working on the topic of business models in the year 2000. And from then onwards, we really started to develop the tools. And that's how the whole thing started, with an academic research. Now here's the difference with everything that was out there. We rigorously tested that in the field. And then, you know, pursued a very visual approach, put it out there, tested it, and the thing took off, right? So that's kind of how it started. And that's one tool. So you need to have a lot more to be able to do innovation. But that's how the whole story started. And then we wrote a book around it, which was very visual, landscape format. We actually, we used an innovative business model because I convinced Eve that we could not write on business model innovation without doing business model innovation. I said, that's not credible. So we came up with a really interesting business model. We co-created, people paid us. It was way before crowdfunding. People paid us to be part of the book project. They have their name in the book. So even today, if you buy Business Model Generation, you can see 470 people who paid us to be part of the book project before the book was even, you know, the ideas were even there. So it was a fun project.
That is amazing. And how did, I mean, usually things that happen in academia don't necessarily reach a big audience. You know, there's some experts who read it in the academic journal. So what did you do to make it popular, or did it just happen organically?
Well, two things. First, again, we tested the stuff we wrote with real entrepreneurs and leaders. And then the second thing is I had a blog at the time. It was early days of blogging, and I put it out there and we could see, you know, how this resonated. So I always tried to keep everything transparent. I always believed in the freemium model of giving a lot away and getting people involved. So, you know, testing stuff makes you a bit vulnerable because people will tell you when stuff's not good, but that's what you want to hear at the early stages. Yeah. So all of that made it extremely relevant and practical to people. And then because of the visual aspect, I think the adoption rate was very high. And we always focused on simplicity. Yeah. I'm a big believer in simplicity. If things are not simple, they won't get adopted. So that was one of the key things, I think, that helped with adoption as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think the genesis of a book is similar to being an entrepreneur, right? At least if you do it right, in terms of the testing, speaking to the audience, getting their feedback, including the feedback, as you said, you know, getting the crowdfunding or, you know, the funding, the buy-in in various shapes and forms. Do you find that as well, that there's some parallels?
So I think the key in entrepreneurship and innovation is process, actually. So we kind of focus on ideas. Ideas don't matter. They're free. They're everywhere. There's tons of opportunities. That's not the problem. People say, oh, I'm just waiting for the right idea. And then I need money and then I can do it. No, like that doesn't matter. It's the testing, adapting, iterating, which is extremely important. And that's, you know, a mix between art and science. The artistic part is seeing patterns, designing great business models, and the scientific part is testing. And you go through this kind of double loop all the time. So it's this back and forth between art and science. It is, you know, entrepreneurship and innovation has an artistic part. Not everybody sees things that entrepreneurs and innovators see, but then again, they're not delusional. They actually test things. So they go back and forth between vision and testing. My friend Steve Blank likes to say there's a fine line between vision and hallucination. So yeah. Great entrepreneurs don't just have a vision, they actually test and iterate to test if it is a hallucination.
Yeah. I think sometimes people are maybe less experienced. They focus on the supply side, right? They want to create something, they have a great idea, they're probably good at something. Whereas the demand side is really what matters to see if something has potential.
Yeah, it's back and forth again, right? So you need to create. But the problem is people think they need to execute. They need to understand there's a difference between execution and exploration. So in innovation and entrepreneurship, you don't need to build something to test. First thing is you just talk to prospective customers and you learn, do they actually have that challenge? Do they have that job to be done? Do they have a budget to pay? What do they already spend on? So before you build anything, and it sounds extremely trivial, but you know, people love to build, in particular scientists and engineers, they love building. And then, you know, everybody thinks, oh, I need to build an MVP to test. No, you don't. You need to understand customers deeply. And then you start to create very simple solutions, but solutions to learn, not solutions to put something out in the market. Now, of course, at one point, you need to have something there that's real, but until you get there, you're already de-risked a lot. And this today is a process. We know exactly how it works. It can be taught. You know, I like to compare it to doctors. You need to learn the anatomy and physiology of business, and you need to practice. So you go back and forth between theory and practice. It's not just listening to entrepreneurs. You're not going to become a great entrepreneur innovator by listening to others. It's by learning the theory. But just by reading books, you don't become a heart surgeon. So you also need to practice. So it's this back and forth. But I do believe now there's enough, you know, business anatomy and physiology to understand how do you design great business models, great value propositions, and how do you test them? This is now a discipline. It's not, you know, just creativity. It's a real discipline with processes. It's almost getting boring and looking more like accounting because we now know how to do it.
Yeah, let's talk about this value proposition. That's the value proposition canvas is part of your toolbox. And it's obviously something we talk about and apply as well in our line of work when we look at messaging and positioning. So for the audience, could you outline what your value proposition canvas entails?
Yeah, so the way it actually started out is we saw people, we said, you map out your business model. They actually tried to map out their product. So we said, okay, well, we need another tool. Not one to replace the business model canvas. The business model canvas is there to sketch out your business model. So we said, what if we had a plug-in tool to zoom into your value proposition? So basically with the value proposition canvas, you make explicit how your bundle of products and services creates value for your customers. How do you address their jobs to be done, their pains and their gains? So you start to map out your customer segment in a slightly more practical way than just with personas. Personas, you say how old they are, what kind of population. That's useless to a certain extent. What you really want to know is what are they trying to get done? What are they struggling with and what are they trying to achieve? If you map that out, you have a great customer profile. And then you make decisions how you're going to address those jobs, pains, and gains with pain relievers and gain creators. So super simple tool to visualize how you're creating value for your customers, to make that explicit. Too few people can articulate how they're creating value for their customers. They will talk about features and performance. All of that doesn't matter if you can't articulate how specifically are you creating value for customers. Sounds so simple, but back to the basics, a lot of people can't say that. They describe the features of their product. Features don't matter unless they address jobs, pains, and gains of specific customer segments.
That is so true. And I love how you outlined the difference between demographics, you know, how old, where do they live, gender, etc. Yes, useful to an extent, but the psychographics of what do people think, you know, what hurts, what's the pain they're looking to mitigate. And they always have this saying, right? People don't want a quarter inch hole. Sorry, they don't want a quarter inch drill. They're looking for a quarter inch hole in the wall. I was that's nonsense. No one wants a hole in the wall. So we took it to the next stage in my latest book, Message Machine. No, actually, you want a painting on the wall. That's what they want. Exactly. They don't want the hole in the wall. So maybe that completes the picture. You also mentioned pain relievers and gainers, something like that.
Gain creators. Double click. Creators. Like a good example of this is why the traditional way of looking customers doesn't really work is There are a couple, right? You know, why does everybody have an iPhone or a Android phone? There's a business model aspect there, but it just addresses jobs, pains, and gains. But if you look at, there's a hotel chain called Citizen M, and they designed a business model for their hotel chain, Citizen M, that targets to one specific customer segment, which they call the mobile citizen. Now, it turns out the mobile citizen could be a business traveler who goes to city for 2 days, could be a culture traveler who goes to city to, you know, go to the museums, or it could be a party traveler who just wants to, you know, hang out in Amsterdam and go party for it. So what do these have in common? They have a couple of jobs, pains, and gains in common. Jobs, they just need to find a decent hotel with an affordable price that doesn't feel cheap, because these are sophisticated people who don't want to be known for going to a cheap hotel, but they don't want to pay a crazy price either, right? Pains, they don't want to pay for Wi-Fi. They want world-class Wi-Fi because that's supposed to be a human right. So what they don't need is a spa when they go to a city for 2 days. They will do that on vacation. But all of these things are in, they have this in common, these very different, you know, demographics, if you want, because we're looking at the same jobs, pains, and gains. And Citizen M nailed that and designed a business model that caters to that specific customer segment. So it's a very different way of looking at customers if you study their jobs, pains, and gains, and then ask, how can I relieve those pains and how can I address those gains with my bundle of products and services?
Yeah. I can hear a lot of founders saying, well, that's great, but how, you know, with my business, I'm doing B2B SaaS, so I need to have decision makers and talk to them. It's just so hard to get to them, right? How can I get 10 CTOs on the phone to ask them my questions? Why would they take time to do that?
Well, two things. If you can't get them, if you can't talk to them, you shouldn't be an entrepreneur in the first place, right? Entrepreneurs, they just get shit done. They get hard shit done. That's the first one. And the second one is, if they don't want to talk to you, probably what you have is not interesting enough because they would take the time. So for me, that's already a sign. Okay, that's not an entrepreneur or innovator. And I'm learning here from Steve Blank, right? He'd say, well, you know, entrepreneurs get stuff done. If you can't, well, probably it's not the wrong job. But the second one is super important, is if they don't invest time, then your solution is probably not relevant to them. And you need to ask, well, how can I become relevant to them? You know, what are the jobs, pains, and gains? And then you work yourself towards them. So, you know, I sell to CEOs all the time. Well, guess what? I didn't get there overnight, but then you start to look at the people who surround the CEO and you start to understand, okay, what could it be? What are the entry points? So you have to do your homework and maybe work with a lot of other people before you actually get access. So that's what you do as an entrepreneur innovator. You find that access. So yes. When people complain, I usually think then they probably shouldn't be an entrepreneur innovator.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's say they want to do it, right? And I hear you. I'm willing to put in the work. What practical advice could you give?
Be creative. So just start to be creative. So the first one, as I said, is you want to talk to a CEO. Well, let's maybe not start with the Fortune, you know, 500s, more difficult because everybody wants to sell them. But if you start lower down, you say, okay, who else could I talk to understand how to even get access? So instead of going right away to the target, ask yourself, what are the channels to get to that target customer segment? What do I need to do, the groundwork, the homework, so that I can get a meeting? That means you talk to staff, right? The stories from the past, right? When you, the assistants, you know, now with the remote work and all that is a bit different, right? But when people would start calling, you know, at the right time when the assistant was gone and the phone lines would go through. That's the kind of stuff that you need to do today. Figure out how can you be creative to get there. So I think creativity is completely underestimated for that kind of stuff. We always think creativity for ideas. Well, guess what? Creativity to figure out, you know, how can I get access and run experiments, way more important than the creativity around your product.
Yeah, I love that. And I throw in a few more. So you can host a dinner party for founders, CEOs, maybe just their associates, right? If you're more sort of young, up and coming, say, well, tons of stuff. I invite 20 founders, associates in my town to a nice dinner or just drinks, right? Something. most stuff happening is boring, so make it interesting. You can, of course, launch a podcast, which is what I've done, to talk to a CEO every week, which is fun. You can also go to a conference. I've done this many times. You go to a conference, there are 10 people on stage you would love to talk to. After they come off stage, like, hey, great to see you again. Here's my book, if you have one. Hey,
how about
talking about this? How about coming on the podcast? You know, how about a cup of coffee? How do you like this? Obviously not hard selling, because they're not in that mindset, but just to show your face. And you can show your face digitally as well. Yeah. If they post on LinkedIn every day, or, you know, 3 times a week at 3 o'clock, be there, be one, the first to comment, just make meaningful contributions, because they do check. Everyone checks who says what in the comments. So there are a few things everyone can do that are almost no cost or very little.
I'll give you an example from my past, and it's a bit a long time ago. So one of the first companies I was involved in was a consultancy to Swiss private banks. So we knew, like, we needed access to CEOs of private banks, not just Swiss private banks, but all over the world. So I said, okay, you know, it's the early days of blog posts. So I just took a camera and asked these people, you know, can we film you and talk to you? And now you'd say, well, private banking, aren't they super private? Well, guess what? CEOs love talking and they love being on camera. Not all of them, but many of them. So that really worked well back then. Today, obviously, it's different because there's so many channels and they get so many requests for these things, but you just need to be creative. Back then, that worked like a charm. We never thought people would be accessible. What, you know what? They all wanted to be on camera and talk and be on a blog.
Yeah.
This won't work today, but that's the kind of stuff you need to figure out. What will work today? And catering to people's ego is something that always works. Flattery and ego, just find the right channel in. And, you know, some will refuse, but many will say yes.
That's the thing. It's a numbers game, right? And I think you have to just be cool with rejection.
Oh, yeah.
I think
that's the number one job of an entrepreneur. Guess what?
Yeah.
The number one job of an entrepreneur and an innovator is to be rejected 10 times a day, to be called stupid. That's not going to work. Like, what do you know? That's not possible. If you can't deal with that, it's super hard. So rejection is one of the, in particular, early stage. Later on, you got to ask yourself, maybe you're doing the wrong thing. But early on, that's a key characteristic that entrepreneurs, they don't have a problem with rejection, very similar to salespeople, and they get up again and again and again. They don't, you know, get pulled down by the negativity that surrounds them. But here's what's important. You do need to listen. So you need to be stubborn, but at the same time, selective listening. What did I learn? What should I actually retain? Because otherwise, you're just being stubborn, and then it will turn out that your vision was a hallucination. So it's a very fine line that you need to be careful with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you have any tips for budding entrepreneurs and people out there who think they would like to develop a thicker skin to deal with the rejection? Because it is coming hard and fast, so it's no getting away from it. But what can people do to develop a thicker skin?
Just go out there and do it, and then see, you're not dead. You're not going to die from this. And you know what? You'll feel bad for a moment. Like, there are moments, you know. I remember, you know, when I was starting to sell to innovation people, and then I was in the lobby, and then it's called, oh, no, Mr. Osterwalder, this and this person doesn't want to see you. You feel really stupid. But did I survive that? You bet. Did I feel bad the 10 minutes or 1 hour after that? Oh, I did. But it's also a reality check, right? So just do it and you'll see. Frankly, there's worse in the world.
Yeah. And I think that for me, that reframe of just, well, most things just don't work out. It's just seems to be law of the cosmos or whatever. But as you said, 90% of things just don't work out. And that's just, so it's just a numbers game. If I make 10 calls, send 10 emails, someone would probably say yes.
And
if not, then I have to change the message
exactly,
or my approach.
Right? Right? And that's the key thing. So you need to experiment a lot. Keep it cheap, right? You don't want to travel around the world to go and see somebody who you're not gonna see. But keep it cheap. And then the things that work, those outliers, you say, okay, that worked. Let me try that again. And you hone in on it. Maybe it was just a one-time thing. But generally, you know, you start to see patterns. So you won't get rejected all the time. And if you do get rejected all the time, well, then probably there's nothing there, right? So just trying out and starting to see the patterns, that's what entrepreneurship is about. That's the artistic part of entrepreneurship. Great entrepreneurs see things others don't. And it comes through actually experimenting a lot, right? So it's this back and forth. Without experimentation, you can't start to see the pattern because that data is not there since you're the first one doing it. But if you do experiment, you will see the patterns emerge.
And I would add, don't take it personally because it is not meant in a personal way.
Yeah.
Someone was busy or maybe the wording wasn't right. And the other thought which came to mind is, look at how people have solved this already, because most problems we face as entrepreneurs have been solved many, many times. So how to write a cold outreach, that's a problem that has been solved, just like the business model canvas has provided a solution to a specific problem. And of course, things change. What works now probably won't work in 2 years from now. What worked 2 years ago doesn't work anymore. But people do it right now, right here, and there are ways to find out how they do it.
Yeah, I think the big one there, to build on what you just said, is learn from others. I think, you know, it's definitely a mistake I did. I'd almost say I was too arrogant. I didn't talk to enough entrepreneurs. I didn't learn from their mistakes. I thought, I can figure this out. And eventually you will. But what you need to understand is it's just extremely costly. Their mistakes I made, I lost millions of dollars, and I could have avoided those if I had been, you know, talking to more entrepreneurs and listen more carefully. So you'll eventually figure it out, but you know, you probably want to do that faster and cheaper. And talking to other entrepreneurs, you know, first-time entrepreneurs, they should probably work in startups first. That makes a phenomenal difference. And that's the big difference between an ecosystem like Silicon Valley, where you start to learn this stuff with 15 with the people around you. It's not the same in Switzerland. Now, is there an ecosystem developing? Yeah, sure. But you need to, you know, really swim in this, but not just in the, you know, cocktail parties and so, really understand what did people get right? What did people get wrong? Learn from that carefully before you do it with your own money, right? So it's much better to work for a couple of startups, watch the stupid mistakes rather than doing them yourself. I've done them all myself and that's expensive. Yeah. So I don't recommend that.
Same. I think like you, I was probably too arrogant and thought I can figure it out. And now I'm very much in the mindset of, okay, this has been solved. There's a playbook. Who has the playbook? Who's done it successfully recently? And speak to them, reach out. Sometimes you buy coaching, sometimes you buy the book or watch the videos. It's a lot of stuff for free or for the price of a book. I mean, it's incredible, the information landscape now. But yeah, sometimes a few coaching hours just to get the download of, okay, there's a specific problem. How have you solved it? Okay, thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah, 100%. And generally, I would say coaching is underestimated. I mean, there's the technical coaching part where typically you look at sales coaching. That's technical stuff. But what has made a huge difference for me is breakthrough coaching. So I always thought, oh, I'm not a manager. And I found that, you know, it was an excuse. If I'm honest today, it was an excuse. Very easy to say, well, I'm not like that. And then at one point with my coach, Shani Ospina, she said, well, do you want to be a CEO or not? That's a decision. It's not in your genetics that you can't be a CEO and that you're a bad manager. That's a choice. And you get that when you work with a coach, a breakthrough coach, who pushes you into that uncomfortable zone, and then you make a choice, do I want to or not? And I think way too few CEOs or founders or entrepreneurs actually realize how much value there is to coaching. Like Roger Federer wouldn't have become one of the world's best tennis players ever if he had never worked with a coach. So how can it be that in business, we see coaching more as, oh, if I have a problem, then I need a coach? No, it's to be world class. If you don't want to be world class, you don't need a coach. If you want to be world class, I recommend you get a breakthrough coach.
Just to double click on that, you said in a previous interview, it was with the Most Awesome Founder podcast, a shout out to Garrett and Dries, great podcast, great friends. You said you wished you would have started with a breakthrough coach earlier in your career, and it has helped you a great deal in recent years. So what should people be looking for in a coach? Who's the right, who's the wrong one? Because everyone can call themselves a coach, right? Yeah. There are a lot out there. So how do you find the right one?
A lot of charlatans, right? So I think coaching is sometimes misunderstood as somebody who listens to you. So there's a bit of that. But coaches get you to the next level. So if you don't have results, breakthrough results by working with a coach, then it's a bad coach. And there's a chemistry there that you need to develop. So I have one, Shani Ospina, who has, you know, interesting techniques, and she always gets me to the next level. Now, at the end of the day, you know, it's not just her work. It's also me making the decision and then changing my habits. But if you can't get there, it's probably the wrong coach. So I just look at the results. Have I changed? And, you know, I this funny story is when I had a coach many, many years ago when I helped build a not-for-profit in Thailand. And then when I started business, at one point I said, I want to coach again. That person was great. So I thought, well, let me start with number one. And who was number one leadership coach at the time? Marshall Goldsmith. So I talked to a friend of mine, Rita McGrath, who's from Columbia Business School, and I said, can you introduce me to Marshall? I want to work with a number one. And you know what? Turned out that he said, I'm not going to coach you, but I have this vehicle. You know, I have the Marshall 100, the Goldsmith 100. And I started to become part of that. So that was a great start, but then I had to find the right person for me, and that was somebody who I found in my network with Shani Ospina. And it was by working with her and getting results, changing, that I realized that's the right person. So you just have to try, and maybe you have to try with a couple until you get the results. But if you don't get results, if you don't change, could be the coach, could be you. But generally, if it's you, then the coach is probably not, you know, the right one to get you to change.
Yeah. And I would add to that, look for someone who's got the track record, who's done it before for themselves, maybe, but also for others, right? There are a lot of people who teach things they haven't really achieved themselves, which is a bit of a bugbear. But I'd love to talk about storytelling and marketing a little bit, because obviously that is an adjacent topic. And in the business model canvas, you talk about storytelling as well. You mentioned that it is an undervalued and underused art in the world of business, and there's a particular expression I like here, which is stories have the power to suspend disbelief in the unfamiliar. Suspend disbelief in the unfamiliar. I really like that.
Yeah, so what does stories actually do is connect with people and then bring them into a different space. So many of the most successful entrepreneurs were not just great doers, but also great storytellers. And of course, you know, then Steve Jobs comes to mind. And so, and what I think today makes a huge difference is when a entrepreneur can really tell a great story about the business model, because it's not just about products. I think the game that's played today is about business models, where the best pieces, you know, fit together to make a real difference. And, you know, sometimes people say, if I just find the right idea, the right product, you can fail with a great product that people love, because at the end of the day, you need to earn more money than you spend. But, you know, think of those stories like Nespresso or Airbnb. They just put the right pieces together, believed in that, and told a story around it. And the story evolves, right? So till you figure out what really works. But if you can't tell that story to your team, to your investors, you will not, to the world, when we're talking about marketing messages, you will not succeed. Right? So it's extremely hard for bad communicators to become successful entrepreneurs and CEOs. Now, I was not a great communicator. I had to learn that. But you cannot. You will never get alignment. You will never get investors. So it is just part of your job to be able to formulate that story so that it connects with a different audiences. And for different audiences, you need different stories, right? So this is not just one story that flies with everybody. It's like the value proposition canvas. Find the story for the audience you're targeting.
Yeah, absolutely. There are inspirational stories you want to tell on stage at a big event. There is the equity story you want to tell to investors. There are customer stories that hopefully work with your customers. Say, we've done this for customer X, we could do this for you, just to name three. But I think the key is to understand the underlying mechanics of storytelling and how and when to use it. Once you understand these, you can apply it to all sorts of different contexts and audiences.
Yeah. I think so, yeah, for sure. I would emphasize not the mechanics of the story. I would emphasize understanding your audience. What are their jobs, pains, and gains, right? So I'll give you a silly example. In innovation, people are so passionate about innovation that they forget, when they talk to the CEO, the CEOs often don't care about innovation, so speak their language. Don't talk about lean startup and experiments. Like, what does the CEO care? What you want to talk about is return on investment. You want to talk about risk. You want to talk about the shareholders. So you need to formulate your stories so that they resonate. So I think there might be sometimes a bit too much focus on the mechanics of a story, forgetting that very, very basic and simple truth. Understand the people you're telling the story to first. And it sounds so trivial, but we forget, you know? And again, I see it. The more you're excited about something, the more you will take your perspective rather than the perspective of the people you're talking to. Happens to me all the time, and then I have to shake myself and say, no, here's a CEO, here's an investor. This story needs to be completely different. The same kernel, but a completely different story that really addresses the jobs, pains, and gains of the people I'm talking to. It's like a value proposition. It's the same thing.
And understand them also at an emotional level, because that's where stories have their most power, their emotional vehicle. So I need to understand the audience's emotion. And there I often think about the internal emotions, sort of the external drivers. And especially in B2B, it may seem like, okay, how can I sell this new software? I tell a story about customers. It's all very rational. Yes, they save some money and a better results. But actually, maybe my counterpart's story inside is, oh, I really need some big wins here internally. Otherwise, I will not be in for that promotion, or maybe there are job cards going around and I worried about position. Yeah. So their sort of internal story is very different from that sort of rational sales story I make it.
You bet. And that's where the whole jobs to be done concept is so powerful. Different people invented the concept, but they also distinguish between more functional jobs. Okay, I'm a CEO, I need to deliver to my shareholders. But then the emotional jobs, very stressful, you know, very stressful environment. I'm going to maybe lose my job. So you want to cater to all of those. Or the social jobs, which is how am I going to be perceived by others? So we forget these things that exist just as much in B2B as in consumer. I actually think the opportunity in business to business is much, much bigger. And so a lot of the clients we sell to with Strategizer, we think about those emotional jobs. Like that we sometimes... or social jobs. We might sometimes sell them a solution that's going to make them irrelevant, because we know innovation so well that they will actually almost look bad in front of their peers because they're not at the same level. So we have to think about that. How do we become their ally and make them look really good? So we tell the story in a different way so that they look good. And that seems, again, it's so trivial, but I can tell you we did this wrong until we figured it out.
Exactly. Making ourselves look good, which is not the point of that conversation.
Exactly.
I mean, you're a fantastic communicator, and you communicate in very different contexts and with different audiences. And of course, first and foremost, you're an entrepreneur. You've also written books, which is a different form of communication. You're on podcast. You are, you know, an in-demand speaker. You're a visiting professor. So you have many hats. And entrepreneur, first and foremost, but wearing different hats. So how do you think about communication when you're not in sort of the entrepreneurial mode on which we have focused so far?
Well, what a lot of people don't know is that when I was at university, I couldn't even speak in front of five people. I had a terror of public speaking. So I was really bad. And that went on after university still. I pushed myself. I became a teaching assistant. So I start playing with it. But then I became a consultant. You have to communicate. I was really, really bad. And then at one point, when we had this consulting firm, there's a coach that came in, and she realized that I'm bad at communicating if I'm at the center of things. But I'm a good communicator if I put the spotlight onto others. So that's when I started to realize, when I give a talk or so, what if I got the audience to participate and put them at the center? So all of a sudden, I thought, how can I get them to work and take me out of the spotlight? So I had to find my own style that works for me. Then I realized I actually really need visuals. I'm not good at telling stories, but I'm good at doing voiceover for things I draw. So I had to find my own style, and that's how I started to get comfortable. And once you start to get comfortable and you get used to it, well, then you become a better public speaker. But I had a terror because I didn't like doing it, because I tried to adopt a way of communicating that was not mine. And the moment I found my style, I started to get comfortable with it, and now I love it. I'm still always nervous. And I remember, you know, Richard Saul Wurman, who was the founder of the TED conference, he said the best speakers are between terror and arrogance. If you're too arrogant, that doesn't work. If you're too terrorized, it doesn't work. So they're always in between. And when I look at other speakers, and I try to watch a lot of speakers and learn from them, then I realize that they're in between that thing. And they all find their own style. So I would recommend find your style that works for you and that makes you comfortable. And if you try somebody else's style, it won't feel natural. So some people on stage, they don't come across as genuine because they don't use their own style.
It's too rehearsed. It's like an actor, an actress. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't connect. And it's not a problem at all if you're a little bit nervous and it shows, because the audience knows it would be terrifying to be up there, and they say, well, that person's courageous, it's all good. And I think we all started there, right? We weren't born as brilliant communicators. And
Some are. I actually do believe some are good storytellers. It's born like that. But if you don't have it, doesn't mean you can't get there. And those Absolutely. Who are, like, they have other weaknesses. Like, we all have our strengths and weaknesses. And if you're a bad communicator today, you know what? Good news is it's not in your DNA. You can actually get there.
You can learn it. And I love it. It requires a bit of courage. But I like what you said about the self-awareness. And one good question to ask is probably, am I most comfortable at my best one-on-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many? And often, as you said, it's one-on-one or maybe one-to-few. And from there, you can obviously build the confidence step by step. So you speak to 5 people and then to 10. So just build it like any skill, build it up over time. And Alex, that was super interesting to get your insights, not just into business model generation, the canvas, the value proposition, you as a communicator, and many other things. So I always ask this as a final question. What's your best piece of communications advice?
Try out a lot of things to see what's going to work. And you'll fail a lot, but you know the thing that works for you will bubble up. So don't fear failure. I think the thing that prevents us from growing is fear of failure. And I think that's one of the only strengths that I have, is relatively ignorant to fear of failure. So I just try out things. I'm scared, shit scared, and I still try them. Somehow I always get myself into situations. Just try.
Yeah, try a lot of things. Someone said that marketing is just a fancy word for trying things out. And I think this is true in general for all sorts of entrepreneurship and communication, for sure. I think that's really, really sound advice. Alex, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening.
Thanks for having me.